Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sandy Hook Elementary School, Newtown, Connecticut, Adam Lanza. Just hearing the words can take us right back to the horror. 26 and 7-year-old children murdered in their school. Teachers and helpers, too. 26 deaths in all 5 years ago. Today, parents of those children are in court trying to sue the manufacturer of those semi-automatic rifle that killed their kids. The same type of assault weapon used to murder so many in Orlando, in Las Vegas, in Sutherland Springs. This hour On Point, after so many mass shootings, the struggle today in court to get a handle on America's guns. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time? And what's the way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will go in a moment to the courthouse in Hartford, Connecticut, where the case is today that would hold gunmaker Remington and more liable in the Newtown shootings. But joining me first from New York is Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, senior research fellow at the Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut, co-host of the Slate podcast, The Political Gabfest. She's followed the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut for the past nearly 5 years now. Emily, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a tough legal challenge that these plaintiffs are up against. Tell us what's unfolding today at the High Court in Connecticut.
What's happening today is that the lawyers for the families of nine of the people who were killed at Newtown and also a teacher who was shot and survived are trying to convince the Connecticut Supreme Court to keep their case alive. And this is a case that is trying to hold the manufacturer of the gun used at Newtown, and that manufacturer is Remington, liable for the injuries and the deaths there. And the plaintiffs, the families, are using a fairly novel legal theory, or at least they're trying to extend a theory to get the gun manufacturer on the hook here.
And what is the theory and what is the challenge? This has already been in the Connecticut courts, and the first judgment was not in the parents' favor.
That's right. And the reason for that initial ruling is a federal law that Congress passed in 2005. It's called the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And that law was designed in a lot of ways to prevent families like these from holding gun manufacturers and sellers responsible. So we have had gun litigation against manufacturers and retailers for many years. Since the 1980s, victims have been trying to hold these actors responsible. And some of those suits were blocked by the courts. A few of them led to damages awards. And in 2005, Congress stepped in and they said that essentially, with some exceptions, they said that if a gun is functioning normally in the way it was intended to function, then the manufacturer is not going to be held liable. But as I said, there are some exceptions. And so the families here are arguing that there's an exception called negligent entrustment, the idea that you've entrusted or given the gun to someone negligently, and that Remington and the gun sellers should be held responsible based on this idea that they negligently entrusted the gun that Adam Lanza used to a civilian.
Let's hear the sound. This is Josh Kuskoff, a lawyer for the Sandy Hook parents, talking at a press briefing in October. We're going to go to the courthouse in just a moment, but saying in October that the company here, Remington, which sells the Bushmaster brand AR-15, markets, he says, the guns to the public knowing that they are meant for war.
Children and the victims in Sandy Hook stared down the barrel of an assault rifle designed for Vietnam and in war. And it was labeled with a Bushmaster label. Because, you see, Bushmaster is a brand. It's a brand that sells these same weapons to the public. These aren't weapons designed for home defense. These aren't weapons designed to hunt. They're designed to kill.
And here at that same briefing, Emily, this is Mark Barden, father of Sandy Hook victim young Daniel Barden, saying that there's a strong case here, he said, because the average citizen should not be able to buy an AR-15 semiotic weapon used for mass killing. He says that manufacturer, the distributor, the point of sale, all should be held accountable.
This is an instrument of war designed for the battlefield that is sold and marketed to the general public. And as we know, this is what happened in Sandy Hook Elementary when the general public gets their hands on this kind of firepower. In less than 5 minutes, we know what happened. And the manufacturer, the distributor, the point of sale should all be accountable.
In less than 5 minutes, 26 dead, 20 young children in Sandy Hook Elementary School. It is in the court today. Emily Bazelon, stand by. I want to turn to Lois Beckett for a moment here. Senior reporter for The Guardian, covers gun policy, politics, criminal justice. She's at the Connecticut Supreme Court, has been there, was there this morning, covering the Newtown parents' hearing. Lois, thank you very much for joining us. What did you hear at the hearing this morning?
So at the hearing this morning, Josh Koskoff, that lawyer for the Sandy Hook families you just heard, was putting a lot of emphasis on the kinds of marketing that these gun companies used to sell these military-style rifles to the public. He cited advertisements that used phrases like forces of opposition, bow down, that used military images, that said things like consider your man card reissued, and asked whether this kind of advertising might have influenced Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook shooter, what he carried out that day. What Koskoff told the court was Remington may never have known Adam Lanza, but they had been courting him for years. So the Sandy Hook parents, and in this case, are not only asking about the capabilities of a rifle like this, whether it's appropriate for civilians, but whether these gun companies purposefully marketed these weapons to young men, including through placement in video games, potentially, in a way that might have influenced a shooter to carry out this kind of attack.
And elaborate, if you would, Lois. I mean, you were there in the courthouse. By what the attorney was trying to suggest when he said they didn't know Remington, the gun manufacturer, did not know Adam Lanza, the killer, but they've been courting him for years. Elaborate on that.
Yes. So the question is whether or not Remington's advertisements trying to market these military-style weapons to civilians using this very aggressive, macho, militarized advertising was in some way contributing or influencing troubled young men like the Sandy Hook shooter, like the Sutherland Springs shooter that we saw again use an AR-15-style rifle and making this gun the weapon of choice for mass shooters. The attorney for the gun companies counters that these rifles are used with perfect safety by millions of Americans, that they are legal, and that there's no reason to blame gun companies for a handful of misuses when most people use these weapons safely.
Did you hear anything of note from the bench today there, Lois?
Yes, the justices of the Connecticut Supreme Court had a lot of questions about why these military-style rifles were being sold to civilians, asked what possible self-defense use that they could have, asked why they were being used to shoot deer. There's also been a lot of attention to whether this claim might survive under the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. So even though the Congress has blocked is trying to protect gun companies from being sued under that 2005 federal law, a question of whether Connecticut state law might provide an avenue for this case to move forward.
Emily Bazelon, you're listening there. You've been following this issue. Lois was in the courtroom today. What's on your mind about how this unfolded there? Emily, what questions come to mind for a reporter who was actually there?
Right. Well, I mean, I think Lois did a great job of laying out the issues. And so, you know, the basic problem here for the Newtown families is that Congress appeared to step in and essentially say we're going to protect these manufacturers from lawsuits. And, you know, so one of the problems is, can you get around legislation through a lawsuit? Or is that kind of end run around federal law through the courts exactly what Congress was trying to prevent. The best precedent here that the families have come from Milwaukee. There was a suit a couple years ago where two police officers who'd been shot succeeded in winning more than $5 million from a gun seller under this theory of negligent entrustment. But the facts were different. The facts in that case, there was videotape showing the gun seller in the store essentially looking the other way for a straw purchase. Like, you could tell from the tape that she didn't really care who she was selling this gun to. And we don't have that kind of evidence in this case. And so that's one of the real legal hurdles that the families face.
Lois, you were there in the courtroom. The families failed in their first at-bat in Connecticut courts. Is there reason to think that this Connecticut Supreme Court might look at this differently?
You know, this is definitely an uphill battle. It has been from the beginning, and the families have always known that. I have to say that I was surprised to hear some of the justices with a line of questioning this morning that really seemed open to considering whether there was a route for the court to move forward on this. At the same time, you know, justices did note that this gun was legally purchased by Nancy Lanza, Adam Lanza's mother. So it's not clear if there was any reason for gun manufacturers or gun sellers or the, you know, the gun store itself, to believe that it would be dangerous in any way to sell this gun to Adam, to Nancy Lanza, you know, who purchased it in a perfectly legal way. But the court does seem at least interested in this line of argumentation that by having Remington advertise very aggressively this gun directly to consumers, to young men trying to grow their market share, that there might be an avenue there to ask what responsibility they might have for that.
What do you think about that avenue to responsibility, Emily, that they marketed to young men who might have the kind of troubled profile that Adam Lanza had, therefore liability?
Well, it's really interesting, and it calls to mind some of the claims against the tobacco companies when we were fighting with them over how they advertise cigarettes. And so you can see the appeal of this line of reasoning for the plaintiffs. It's one thing to sell the guns. It's another thing to aggressively push them on young men and make it seem as if this military use is relevant to them. So maybe the state law claim under the Connecticut Unfair Practices Act could come into play here. I think there is a problem potentially, though, from the First Amendment. So you could imagine the Connecticut Supreme Court being drawn to this idea of restricting advertising or penalizing for advertising. But then the companies also have free speech rights.
Lois, just a couple of seconds. Were families in the courtroom today, families of the victims?
Some of them are expected to speak after after the hearing ends today. And it is very hard. Every time they speak about this case, they are pale-faced and grim to have to revisit this all over again, trying to hold someone responsible.
Lois Beckett with The Guardian, joining us from just outside the courthouse in Hartford, Connecticut. The Connecticut Supreme Court with this case is being heard today. Lois, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the families of Newtown, Connecticut victims going to court again to make gun manufacturers, or to try to make them liable for the deaths caused by their guns, and the wider prospects for gun control after Las Vegas and Sutherland Springs and Orlando and, yes, Sandy Hook. You can join us this hour. Does just hearing the names Newtown and Sandy Hook take you back to the stunned horror of that day nearly 5 years ago now when all those school children died? Did you think that was the moment when things would change? Are we getting numb after Charleston and Vegas and Orlando and Sutherland Springs? And should gun makers be liable for the murders, mass murders, committed with their guns? It is a heavy lift. U.S. law since 2005, quite clear on this, federal law. But parents of victims at Sandy Hook hoping and here trying again last month. This was Nicole Hockley, mother of Sandy Hook victim Dylan Hockley, and one of the families bringing suit here, spoke at a press conference about how the shooter, Adam Lanza, chose a weapon meant to kill many people.
There were a lot of guns that our shooter could have chosen from his arsenal and his mother's arsenal in order to attack the people at Sandy Hook School. He chose the AR-15 because he was aware of how many shots it could get out, how lethal it was, the way it was designed, that it would serve his objective of killing as many people as possible in the shortest time possible.
Of course, the NRA and more have pushed back right from almost the beginning. This was April 2013, after Connecticut passed a comprehensive gun control bill, banned the sales of magazines carrying more than 10 bullets. Wayne LaPierre, the NRA executive VP and CEO, then was asked by then Fox's Megyn Kelly if he thought fewer children would have been killed at Sandy Hook if the shooter hadn't had 30-bullet magazines with that Bushmaster AR-15. Here was LaPierre's response.
The problem with what Connecticut did, Megyn, is the criminals, the drug dealers, the people that are going to do horror and terror, they aren't going to cooperate. I mean, all you're doing is making the law books thicker for the law-abiding people. And, I mean, from the very start, my thought has been how little of this has to do with actually keeping kids safe and how much it has to do with this decade-long agenda against firearms.
A decade-long agenda against firearms. John Donahue and David Koppel join us in just a moment. Emily Bazelon is with us. Lots of callers here. Decatur, Illinois, Sherry's calling. Hi, Sherry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I am really outraged that Congress would pass a law in 2005 that says gun manufacturers are not liable for anything. We have no recourse. How can we, as a people, get rid of that stupid law?
Emily, you can speak to that, but we change laws by changing or persuading lawmakers, I guess, Emily.
Right. And I think, though, that the caller's frustration is probably shared by a lot of people, because when you poll Americans about gun control and gun safety laws, they are overwhelmingly in favor of stricter legislation than we have. And probably that would include this, opposition to this law that protects gun manufacturers. However, Congress has not passed those kinds of laws. They've passed this law protecting the gun sellers and the gun makers. And, you know, that has to do with how passionate each side has been in the past. People who want strong Second Amendment rights and oppose gun restrictive laws tend to feel very strongly and vote on those preferences, while other people sometimes vote on other issues. And then there's also the power of the NRA and the way in which its donations members of Congress have also influenced our politics on this issue.
You've had politicians talking about this. Among them, kind of famously after Sutherland Springs, was Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, saying, let's keep politics out of this after the terrible death toll there, unwittingly making a kind of pro-gun control observation. He was talking to CNN here from Sutherland Springs the day after the church shooting there. Ted Cruz.
We don't need politics right now. You know, I would note in New York, we saw a terror attack just this week with a truck. Evil is evil is evil, and will use the weaponry that is available.
Evil will use the weaponry that is available. Of course, we've seen what's available in this country, and it's a lot. Emily Bazelon, please stand by there in New York. John Donahue joins us right now from Stanford, California, law professor at Stanford, expert on gun policy and the criminal justice system. John Donahue, thank you very much for being with us today. What do you make of the Newtown parents' second attempt here to find some liability for the gun manufacturer, distributor, and more in the courts? Professor Donahue.
Well, you can understand their frustration. And I do think in general, if you just think in intuitive terms, we know that Nancy Lanza herself was very influenced by the sort of extravagant claims that the NRA and gun manufacturers will make about the value of these weapons. Nancy Lanza, living in Newtown, Connecticut, literally one of the safest places in America, felt she needed an arsenal to protect herself. And of course, the irony is that it not only did not protect her, but her foolishness of making those weapons available to her son led to the death of many others. So the object for a wise government is to craft the restraints that will make men and women free. And I think we're doing a bad job of that overall right now in the United States. And when the people finally get that message, there will be more reasonable measures to restrict gun violence.
We'll look at the courts and beyond here. Tricia in Mentor, Ohio. Tricia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
For 3 years, I lived in a town in Scotland called Dunblane, and every morning I walked my daughters to school. I passed the graveyard where 16 children are buried from the school shooting there in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Every morning I felt that, and I don't think you have to have children to feel the outrage. The good thing about what happened in the UK was that the gun control laws were changed. I think that what's lacking in our country is a sense of outrage and at the companies that are producing and distributing these weapons and making them so readily available, to the Congress and its connections to the NRA and big business. So I just wanted to call in and express my profound and passionate support for these parents who are trying to make some changes in our country. And I hope and wish for them the best.
Tricia, I appreciate your call very much. Emily Bazelon, John Donahue, stand by. Dave Koppel joins us right now. He's Associate Policy Analyst at the Cato Institute, author of The Truth About Gun Control. Dave Koppel, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You hear that call for more outrage and action on guns there from our caller in Ohio. You have been an opponent of more gun control. What do you think of that? The call for something to happen here that you hear from Tricia and the case before the Connecticut court, Dave?
Well, our gun laws are supposed to be made by our elected officials, the legislatures in the states and nationally. And that's the point of the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which is to say we are not going to pervert normal lawsuits to allow them to become backdoor gun bans. If you want to ban guns, pass a law in the legislature, but it's not the job of the courts to overrule the role of the legislature in determining what firearms are lawful or not. Connecticut had enacted a ban on so-called assault weapons back in the early 1990s, and the guns that Remington was selling in this case were completely compliant with the laws of Connecticut against what Connecticut called assault weapons. Connecticut, since the 1920s, has had some of the strictest gun laws in the United States, and every firearms purchase there is approved by law enforcement beforehand. So it's not fair or logical to say that when every step in a transaction, including the consumer's purchase of a firearm, is approved by law enforcement under the laws made by the legislature, that somehow is something that should be the basis of a lawsuit.
Our caller, Tricia in Ohio, Emily, and I know we have to let you go in just a second here, but Tricia says she sees the Congress as a prisoner of the NRA and the gun manufacturing industry. Of course, there are a lot of just straight-up strong supporters of the Second Amendment who don't want restrictions as well. After all these shootings, Emily, do you see some change in our legislation or court rulings that might change the profile of Americans' armed-to-the-teeth status?
Well, I mean, this is really on Congress, and you can see Congress as a prisoner. But, of course, Congress can change what it's going to do. It is very hard, though, to see movement in Congress on this issue right now. Connecticut, though, we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. I happen to live in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Connecticut has had a lot of success in reducing gun killing since it passed more restrictive gun legislation in the 90s. Homicides went way down in Connecticut. And interestingly, in Missouri, a place that loosened restrictions on gun ownerships, gun deaths went up. So, you know, you can make of that what you will, but when we're talking about what is effective here, what matters, there is room for the states to take action.
Emily Bazelon, Senior Research Fellow at Yale Law School, with us today from New York. Emily, thank you, as always, for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dave Koppel, John Donahue, stand by. Larry's calling from Detroit. Larry, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Like everyone else, my sympathies go out to the parents who lost this lost children in Sandy Hook.
Sympathies.
But they lost it to an extremely disturbed individual who actually kept lists of serial killers or mass murderers and had an intention to do that kind of damage. More importantly, to the lawsuit itself, our country is based on law. Law is based on precedent. And the case that they're trying to make here that the Remington company, through their advertising, influenced this person, first of all, sets up it's based in bad law. That's why they've lost so far. But the precedents would be quite easy to adapt to a clothing manufacturer. There's a company called FUBU who markets to urban communities, and their clothing is worn by many gang members. Here in Detroit, in like many countries, many cities across the country, has a problem with gangs. So this case essentially would open up, if they were to win, the ability for people to sue FUBU, because they market to an urban community, they market to people who wear their clothes to commit violent acts as gang members. So now are we going to put that company out of business because their marketing plan markets to gang members and they do violence and they kill more people than Sandy Hook?
Yeah, Larry, we've got it. Let us pick it up. John Donahue, what about it? First of all, just go to the argument that the attorneys are making in Connecticut today that, you know, liability lies here with Remington because of negligent entrustment. And that's in the law. There's a accommodation for that in this law. But that they have effectively put these weapons in the hands of the wrong kind of people because of the kind of marketing they've done. And you hear, what about that just on its face? And then what about Larry's argument? Well, pretty soon you'll have clothing manufacturers in the dock.
Well, the lawsuit in Connecticut has two dimensions. As you mentioned, negligent entrustment is one, but there's also the unlawful advertising and marketing dimension. I think Larry's point is worth considering, although, of course, in any event, if the courts allowed a lawsuit like this to go forward, a jury would have to say that we believe that the unlawful behavior was a proximate cause of the harm, and that would be obviously a tough sell in the clothing manufacturing case. Not as tough a sell, obviously, in the gun case. But I do think David Koppel just made the point that the gun laws are to be passed in the legislature, but he doesn't point out that his ally in the NRA is constantly going around the country trying to repeal the laws passed. For example, I live in California, and the NRA has sued to stop the ban on high-capacity magazines, has sued to stop the state-adopted restrictions on gun carrying. So you really can't have it both ways if you're speaking on this issue. If you want the legislature to pass laws, the NRA should back off and let states like California have bans on high-capacity magazines and on assault weapons and on restrictions on gun carrying. And the NRA is certainly not doing that.
But can you see a court saying, well, yeah, they had product placement in videos where we see people shooting all kinds of humans, and therefore they're liable for what Adam Lanza did? Can you imagine that, John?
You know, I think even if they allow the case to go forward, it's going to have to go to a jury and we'll see what the evidence shows. I do think that there's a possibility that the court could say, as we look at the advertising, it has a deceptive quality about it, suggesting that in some ways these weapons could improve safety, and there's no way in which guns like this could improve safety for either the possessors or the community at large. And that deceptiveness could be thought as contributing to Nancy Lanza's decision to purchase this in the first place and then make it available to her son. So I think it's a possibility that the courts would say, well, there's deception on its face here, and we'll allow a jury to consider based on what the evidence shows as to whether this was a significant enough impact on Adam Lanza to say the company's actions were approximate cause of the death. I do think an important part of this is the litigants would like to have discovery so that one could bring to the public some of the evidence within the files of the gun manufacturers about the deceptive trade practices that they've been engaged in much the same way in the tobacco litigation that public opinion turned greatly when it was seen that the tobacco executives were lying about their advertising decisions. And if you look in the records of the tobacco files, you'll see connections between the tobacco industry and the NRA. And I'm sure the NRA doesn't want to have those come out through this litigation.
But I suppose it could if they remand this or ask for discovery. That means, is that like open season on the records of Remington?
Well, in typical discovery of a lawsuit, you're allowed to get records that are relevant to the decisions of executives in making their advertising. And I'm sure there will be evidence in there that the NRA and the gun manufacturers would not like the public to see, because it would be suggestive of many of the claims that the lawyers in this case have made.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the families of Newtown, Connecticut, victims there nearly 5 years ago, December 14th, 5 years ago, 2012, going to court today, again, to make gun manufacturers, or try to make them, liable for the deaths caused by their guns. And the wider prospects for gun control, if that's in the wind after Las Vegas and Sutherland Springs. John Donahue is with us from Stanford University, David Koppel from the Cato Institute. You can join us. What do you think? Should gun makers be liable for the murders, mass murders of their guns? The law says broadly no, but there might be a way through. We will see in Connecticut. Dave, I want to bring all this to you. A quick call first. Eric in Somerville, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you know, Eric?
Great. So I was a Marine Corps vet and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan as an infantryman and machine gunner. And when I think about the place of weaponry and the role of weaponry here domestically, my experience was being armed to the teeth with everything from a knife to a pistol, shotgun, M16, which is the military designation for the AR-15, up through fully automatic machine guns and grenade launchers, hand grenades, landmines. You can think about all of these things, and if you put them on a spectrum and think about the varying degree of lethality for all of these different weapons, which of course they're designed to kill, and that's exactly what they do, it's strange to me because we have strong precedent here in the United States. I can't, I'm driving down the street in my pickup truck. I can't have someone in the back of it with a 50 caliber machine gun, because in the 1930s we determined that machine guns were too lethal. Mm-hmm. And, so how is it that as a young Marine going through recruit training, I had to spend 2 months eating, sleeping, bathing with, an M16 or an AR-15 rifle? I had to learn the ins and outs of it. I had to dry fire. I had become acquainted with this device and develop a degree of respect for this device before I was even able to put a round in it and shoot on the target range.
Well, let's say that gun owners were required to go through that before they had an AR-15. Would that make you comfortable then with those in our midst, Eric, as an Afghan vet?
I don't think so. I think we really have to look at this kind of spectrum of lethality. And if, in my perspective, we've allowed technology, the technology behind these weapons and the killing power behind these weapons has really outpaced our legislation. So we already have a precedent for drawing lines. And I think that the national dialogue needs to center itself around, is it time to shift that line? Has technology outpaced the legislation? And are these weapons too powerful to be put in the hands of citizens here domestically.
Eric, stick with us for a second. Dave Koppel, what do you say to Eric's line of questioning or challenge?
Well, that's a good argument to make for to a legislature. It's not a judicial argument. The polls show that the public, by a margin of 72 to 26%, favors the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which says that if you want to change the gun laws, go argue in front of, testify in front of a legislative committee. But that's not the job of the courts.
Look beyond the courts for a second, then, onto this issue of lethality. Would you recommend that we rein it in? Do we have weapons that are simply too powerful out there in our civil society?
Well, as he says, that's a decision that we made as a society with laws about machine guns in the 1930s and then expanding them in the 1980s. Semi-automatic firearms fire one bullet every time the trigger is pressed, just like every other normal firearm. They were invented in 1885. They are not any kind of new technology. I represent law enforcement pro bono in various courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, and law enforcement officers pervasively carry guns like the one shot at a time, not machine gun, AR-15, in their patrol vehicles, and they carry those guns for only one purpose, which is the protection of innocent life, of themselves and others. These are guns that are well-suited, superior to many other guns, for that particular purpose of the protection of innocent life, and the exact same reasons why law enforcement officers do choose this gun for keeping the peace, for the protection of innocent life.
But now we have a mass shooting problem. We clearly have a mass shooting problem by exactly those guns.
Yeah,
I mean, Adam Lanza, what was it, 150 rounds in 5 minutes, 26 dead?
Yes, and that's a rate of fire that could be duplicated by many other guns, many of them a century old. We know that two-thirds of gun murders are perpetrated with handguns, but we don't ban handguns from everyone because a few people misuse them for crime. That's why we have a Second Amendment, which is to protect the rights of the law-abiding to own the most appropriate arms for lawful protection.
Yeah, and yet we don't have 50-caliber machine guns roaming the streets, as Eric says. John Donahue, how about it? We've got a vet saying this is too much lethality on our streets. We've got Dave saying, look, this is covered by the Second Amendment, and back off. There's upside here.
Well, I think Eric actually hit the exact right tone. If you're interested in reducing overall gun violence and gun deaths in the United States, you do want to think in exactly the way that he did. What are the benefits of having guns, and at what point do they cross over to imposing more costs and burdens? And so after Australia had a similarly horrifying mass shooting in 1996, they got rid of all of these semi-automatic weapons of the nature that were used in Newtown and in so many of these other mass shootings, including the Texas shooting of just last week. And they've had a perfect record of no further mass shootings since 1996, even though they had 13 in the immediately preceding decade and a half.
But we sell thousands of these in this country every year. I can't even imagine how many there are out there right now if we were to even try to mop them up. I mean, Eric, you're the vet listening. Can you imagine us getting these guns out of circulation in this country?
Well, that would certainly be a monumental task at this point. But, you know, I think it starts with acknowledging, I believe it was Dave, was drawing up, in my opinion, quite a bizarre parallel between a modern AR-15 or M16 to 19th century weaponry. That's just a very strange parallel.
Why?
And I would... Well,
they were invented in 1885. There's no parallel.
You can talk about... I mean, you can talk about semi-automatic weapons. I mean, the M1 that was used during World War II is a semi-automatic weapon, and that had a five-round magazine, and yeah, certainly less lethality.
The M1 carbine, a 30-round magazine.
If you look at if you have experience with these weapons, you can understand that the technology has advanced dramatically. And, you know, if that wasn't the case, if these weapons weren't such an effective killing machine, why on earth would we be using them to arm the United States Marine Corps and the infantry that's going out and fighting the wars?
Clearly, there is not a single country in the world that uses the AR-15 as a military rifle, including the United States. No country uses semi-automatic, gunshot at a time, AR-15 as a military weapon.
Yeah, let's just, Eric, okay. You know, you hear Dave saying it's not the same, an M16 and AR-15.
There's such a nuanced difference. The difference between the M16 and the AR-15 is an opportunity to switch it into a burst mode to shoot three rounds at once versus one round at a time.
Yeah.
And there's some enhancements, I believe, in the sights and I think a bayonet clip. I think those are the primary differences between these two weapons. And as someone that fought a war and has a tremendous amount of experience with the M16, as a Marine, you're taught not to use the burst mode. You're only taught to employ the weapon in a single shot mode because it is the most effective way of using that weapon. And I can tell you that I never fixed my bayonet, so that wasn't really a feature that I used. So I think it's a stretch to look at some of these things and twist some of these things to say there's no advancements in technology over the past 100 years or there's significant differences between the military versions and the civilian versions of these weapons. Starting to shift the dialogue and say, you know, these technology has advanced. It's advanced in every other category, in cars and computers and homes.
Eric, we've got it. A veteran of the Afghanistan war saying no thank you to this. The courts in Connecticut today looking at exactly what liability manufacturers might have, the whole country watching after our series of mass shootings here. I want to thank John Donahue at Stanford, Dave Koppel at the Cato Institute, both for being with us today. We're going to turn in another direction right here and right now. But Dave and John, thank you very much for your time. In a moment, we talk to author and award-winning journalist and Texan Richard Parker, who is writing that Christians must support gun control. This is On Point. Richard Parker joins me now via Skype from Wimberley, Texas, award-winning author and journalist, op-ed contributor to the New York Times, columnist for the Dallas Morning News, a Texan. He's also author of Lone Star Nation, How Texas Will Transform America. He wrote an essay for the Times last weekend headlined, Why Christians Must Support Gun Control. You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Richard Parker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What's at the heart of your argument?
The striking thing about this horrific incident in Sutherland Springs to me was the sort of the most obvious one. And that was that you had a Sunday sermon turned into a slaughterhouse inside of a sanctuary, a church. And it struck me that when you look back at the recent history of mass shootings in the United States, and they're not the only form of violence, that people of faith, and by that I mean particularly Christians, which I count myself one, however imperfect, we have a duty, a moral obligation, which has been spelled out over the centuries, to protect innocent life. And by simply shrugging our shoulders, accepting this as the new normal, or trusting that a good guy with a gun will beat a bad guy with a gun, that we are committing a sin, essentially.
You have very prominent Christians, though, who don't go down that road, even as they bemoan what happened here. I mean, Vice President Mike Pence holds his faith very publicly. And, of course, he was in Sutherland Springs. Listen to him for just a moment with me, Richard, if you would, visiting with relatives of the victims. Here's Vice President Pence last week.
3 days ago, evil descended on this small town and on this small church. We gather today to grieve with those who grieve, but also we gather in the resolve that this evil must come to an end in our land.
The resolve that this evil must come to an end in our land, and they're a very publicly self-professed Christian saying that. Is that what you're looking for, Richard?
Yes. Unfortunately, the vice president doesn't spell out what that resolve looks like. And there are sins of commission, and there are sins of omission. And our current political culture is engaged very much in the latter. When you look back at recent history, leaders of various churches have looked at human tragedies on a big scale, whether they're wars or genocide, and confessed after the fact that we should have intervened. And I fear that we will look back at this period and have the same regret.
How do you see, and we're looking at one religion here. This is a country of many religions, and I don't mean to privilege any religion by the conversation, but there are an awful lot of Christians in this country, and these killings happened in a Christian church, in a Baptist church.
A Baptist church, correct.
How do you see the teachings of this faith on this front, Richard?
Well, to be fair, evangelicals have parted ways on the issue of gun restrictions in this country with mainline Protestants and Catholics. That has been true, and I think it's informed by two things. One is political affiliation. You just simply find more Republicans in Baptist pews than necessarily an Episcopal one, and that's fine. And the second thing is a distrust of a society that they believe does not fully embrace God. That's a fair argument.
But evangelicals are not exempt from the teachings of the faith. On the contrary, they profess to be closely holding them. I mean, you're citing faith traditions back to Thomas Aquinas here.
Correct. And I think that one of the reasons I wrote the piece, and I thought heavily about mixing guns and God in the same argument, trust me, one of the reasons I wrote the piece was it's important that all people of any faith or any belief system, really, get behind this, because it's not merely being a Christian, as you point out. All the people of the Abrahamic religions have a duty to protect the innocent, and it's just that simple. And to simply say, as the vice president said, that this is evil, and so it's some sort of supernatural force that we will never really control, but we'll engage in a shadowy struggle with it, is an abdication of one's duty to act.
You're making a kind of appeal here, then. So what is your appeal to fellow Christians in your case?
Well, I think we will have to walk the fine line between gun control and the Second Amendment. I'm a gun owner. I'm a Texan.
Mm-hmm.
I have a healthy respect for guns. I have absolutely no need, desire, or obligation, frankly, under the Constitution, to own an AR-15 or an AK-47 or any derivative of either one. And we will probably not stop humans from killing one another. That goes back to the Old Testament. But if we want to stop the mass slaying of innocent lives, then we can, and have a moral obligation, in my view, to ban semi-automatic gas-operated weapons that have been purchased by the military. There is no discernible reason for a civilian to own one, let alone carry one.
And you see that as a matter of faith obligation in your faith view?
I do. I really do. I was astonished at what happened in Newtown. It made me weep like anybody, because I had kids, you know, and those could have been my kids. To go to a church on a Sunday that had been turned into a slaughterhouse is the ultimate form of sacrilege.
Richard Parker, with us from Waverly, Texas. Grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you very much for your thoughts right there. Listeners, thanks for all your contributions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.